Now Falcon, who the day before had gone to the railroad depot in Bismarck to see his brother and sister off, had delayed his own departure until after the 7th left on their scout. He'd come to the field with him and was sharing a tent with Mark Kellogg, who was a reporter for the Bismarck Tribune and the New York Herald. Kellogg was sitting at a small field table, writing.
Colonel McAllister, what do you think of this? General George A. Custer, dressed in a dashing suit of buckskin, is prominent everywhere. Here, there, flitting to and fro in his quick, eager way, taking in everything connected with his command, as well as generally with the keen, incisive manner for which he is so well known. The general is full of perfect readiness for the fray with the hostile Red Devils. And woe to any of the scalp lifters that come within reach of himself and his brave companions in arms.
Sounds like you think the Indians will be easy.
Oh, come on, please, Colonel McAllister. Against General Custer and the mighty 7th, I've no doubt there will be some difficult times on the march. But as to any actual fighting, the Indians will scarcely give battle, I think.
We shall see, Mr. Kellogg.
Before I forget, just before you returned from Bismarck, a Western Union courier left this telegram for you.
Colonel Falcon McAllister, Fort Lincoln, Dakota Territory, from Major Adrian Brisbane, Fort Junction, Colorado Territory. Colonel, it is with great regret that I inform you that Sergeant Major Sean O'Leary, Corporal Darrell Bates, and Privates Deacon Morgan and Smith were killed while attempting to deliver Gatling guns to Fort Junction. Stop. It wasn't until after they were killed that Private Willie Crawford reported overhearing some of a telegraph message sent by Graham Potter, in which Potter was talking about the guns. Stop. I immediately placed Potter under arrest and questioned him. Stop. From what we have been able to gather, the man Potter dealt with was Cleet Harris. Stop. We believe Harris is going into the Montana Territory to sell the Gatling guns to Indians and is there even now. Stop. We have also learned that the rifles we believed lost in transit were in fact deliberately sent to a false location by Potter, so Harris could acquire them. Stop. It is believed that Harris sold these guns to the same Indians that General Custer will be conducting his expedition against. Stop. I hoped to get even more information, but somehow Potter has managed to escape. Stop. In the meantime, Governor Rout requests that you extend his apology to General Custer for any problem these repeating rifles may have caused him, and he asks you to attempt to find the Gatling guns. Stop. Adrian Brisbane, Major Commanding Officer, Acting, Colorado Home Guard.
Damn.
What is it, Colonel? Trouble?
Yeah, in fact, it could be a lot of trouble. I need to talk to Custer. Colonel McAllister reporting, sir. May I enter?
Come in, Colonel. Colonel McAllister, how nice of you to call. Won't you have a cup of hot tea? It will help to push away the gloom of this cold, rainy day.
Well, thank you, Mrs. Custer, but I need to speak to the General if he is here.
Yes, he is here. He is in the back, putting on some dry clothes. I'll get him. Lorena, you don't mind entertaining Colonel McAllister for a few moments, do you?
Oh, of course not. I would be happy to entertain the Colonel.
Lorena, I'm sorry that such awful weather is spoiling your adventure.
Oh, don't be silly, Falcon. Weather like this is part of the adventure.
Am I like the weather?
I beg your pardon?
Am I a part of your adventure?
Why, Falcon McAllister, how clever you are. Is that what you want to be? A part of my adventure?
Colonel McAllister, are you staying dry?
I am, yes. Thanks to Mr. Kellogg generously sharing his tent with me.
And Libby said you wanted to see me.
Yeah, I do.
Falcon showed Custer the telegram he had received from Major Brisbane. Custer read it, then nodded.
Am I to understand that this man, Potter, is responsible for supplying the Sioux with repeating rifles?
I'm afraid so, General.
You were right to come to me with this. What are you going to do now?
Well, General, as you can see from the telegram, Governor Rout wants me to find the Gatling guns before they too wind up in Indian hands. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm afraid I'm going to have to borrow a horse from you.
Yes, of course. See the saddler, Sergeant. Tell him I said let you pick out any horse you want.
Well, thank you, General.
Do you have any idea where to start looking for these guns?
Not exactly.
You aren't just going to go hither and yon searching for your Indians like Diogenes, carrying his lantern in search of an honest man, are you?
Whatever works.
Well, I do have an idea. That is, if you are amenable to it.
At this point, General, I'm open to any suggestion.
You could come on this scout with us.
I don't know. I don't know how much looking I would be able to do if I stayed with you.
Oh, don't get me wrong. You don't have to stay with us. As a matter of fact, I wouldn't want you to. You would be acting as a scout. That way you can break away from us anytime you want, go anywhere you want, but always have a base to which you can return. And you'd be able to perform double duty, looking for the Gatling guns while at the same time helping us look for the Indians.
If I agree to do that, General, you will have to know that my first duty will be to find those two guns.
That's fine. I, for one, would not want to have those Gatling guns in the hands of the Indians. So, in that respect, you would be serving me even as you serve yourself.
All right, General. I'll go along with that.
Good, good. And I have just the scout to work with you.
Oh, there's no need for that, General. I wouldn't want to take one of your scouts away from his regular duty.
Believe me, Falcon, if there is any chance that there may be a couple of Gatling guns out there, helping you find them would be a part of his regular duty. I think you'll find him very helpful. He used to live with the Indians. He speaks the language, and he knows the area.
Custer stuck his head out of the tent.
Trooper, find Isaiah Dorman. Tell him I wish to see him.
The trooper hurried off on his errand.
I think you'll find Dorman an interesting fellow. He's been a mail carrier. No easy job out here where you have to travel hundreds of miles in a trackless wilderness all alone. And he was a guide and interpreter for the builders of the Northern Pacific Railroad. Mr. Dorman also acted as an interpreter for me on a few occasions.
A moment later, the flap to the tent parted and Dorman stepped inside.
General, you wanted to see me?
Falcon was surprised to see that Isaiah Dorman was a black man.
Yes. Take Colonel McAllister to see the saddler sergeant. Tell Fitzsimmons I said he's to make a horse available for the colonel. The colonel has some looking to do, and I want you to go with him. He'll fill you in.
All right, General. You want to come with me, Colonel? We'll get you that horse.
I like the looks of that horse.
Falcon pointed to a large buckskin.
Commands, come here.
The horse, shaking his head, came over to Dorman and began nuzzling him.
This noble beast belongs to Captain Keogh. He put so much store in him that he bought him from the army just so no one else ever ride him.
Falcon reached up to tug on Comanche's ear.
Well, I don't blame him. It's a good-looking horse. And you can tell by looking at him, he has a spirit.
That's a good horse over there.
Dorman pointed to a bay.
I'll take your word for it.
I'll get him saddled for you, Colonel.
May 17th, 1876, Fort Lincoln, Dakota Territory. The next day, Falcon sat his horse as he watched the last of Custer's troops ride off into the distance. Then he saw Isaiah Dorman riding toward him at a fairly rapid trot.
Have you watched all the soldier boys go by, Colonel?
I have.
And if you come with me, we'll get the scout.
Falcon and Dorman quickly caught up to the group of scouts who were presently riding behind the main group of soldiers. The scouts were led by Lieutenant Charles Varnum, and he came back to speak with Falcon.
Colonel, I'm not exactly sure what the protocol is here. Clearly you outrank me, but I...
Lieutenant, as you can see, I'm not in uniform. This is your command. You do whatever you plan to do without regard to me. For the most part, I'll just be coming along for the ride. But in fact, I plan to go out on my own quite a bit to try to locate those two Gatling guns before the Indians get them.
Yes, sir. Well, if there's anything I don't want, it's to have those Indians with Gatling guns, so please do whatever you have to do. And if you need me for anything, just let me know.
How about letting Isaiah Dorman ride with me? He knows the lingo. If we run into any friendly Indians, he might be able to help me find the guns.
All right. General said to make them available to you. Dorman, you ride with the colonel.
Yes, sir.
As the two men rode away from the rest of the 7th, Falcon looked back in time to see how Custer had organized his line of march. He divided his command into 3 battalions, taking the center battalion himself, giving the right wing to Major Marcus Reno, a junior major, and the left wing to Captain Frederick Benteen, a senior captain.
Mr. Dorman, what do you think of Reno and Benteen?
You ask me, the general's just asking for trouble with them two.
What'd you mean?
If you was to give a boot full of piss to Reno, he wouldn't have sense enough to pour it out with the instructions on the bottom. If you was to give it to Benteen, why, that evil sumbitch more than like to pour it out on Custer.
Mr. Dorman, a person as observant as you is the kind of man I need if I'm going to have any chance at all finding those Gatling guns.
May 17th, 1876, Little Heart River. Custer and the 7th Cavalry reached the first crossing of the Little Heart River at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Here, the entire expeditionary force was brought together under General Terry. The force consisted of the 7th Cavalry, commanded by Custer with 28 officers and 747 men, two companies of the 17th Infantry and one company of the 6th Infantry, comprising 8 officers and 135 men, one platoon of Gatling guns with 2 officers and 32 men, and 45 scouts. In addition, the wagon train had 114 6-mule teams, 37 2-horse teams, and 70 other vehicles, including ambulances, with 85 pack mules, all manned by 179 civilians. Included in that number were Boston and Audie Reed Custer. As the regiment settled in for its first night's encampment that afternoon, Falcon and Dorman started out on their first scout. They rode about 10 miles out, but saw nothing of particular interest until Dorman pointed out an elk.
If I'm going to be riding with someone out in Injun territory, I'd like to have an idea as to how he can shoot. It'll be a good shot if you can bring him down, and a little roast elk is a heap better than Skillgilly.
A roast elk doesn't sound bad.
Falcon pulled out an army carbine from the saddle sleeve. Raising the sharps, Falcon took aim.
Damn! You hit his head plumb center. Colonel, you can ride with me anywhere.
Falcon and Dorman returned to join the regiment just as the 7th was going into bivouac. Benteen was standing beside one of the wagons with his shirt off and his gold-colored suspenders down along his sides, hanging in such a way as to make a loop across the gold stripe on his pants. The captain had lather on his face, and he was looking into a mirror that was propped on the side of the wagon. He looked around as Falcon and Dorman returned to the camp.
Colonel, if you'll excuse me, I'm going to look up Bloody Knife.
Sure, go ahead.
Did you find anything?
Nope.
Well, I didn't think so. You aren't likely to find anything as long as you have that nigger with you.
Oh? I don't know why you'd say that. Mr. Dorman seems quite capable to me.
Oh, it's not a question of his capabilities. It's a question of his loyalty.
Why would you question his loyalty?
He turned Indian out here. They call him Black White Man. And he's married to a squaw from Inkpaduta's band of the Santee Sioux.
I thought he'd been working for the army for some time now.
Oh, he don't mind taking money from us. But this'll be the first time he's ever had to go up against his own.
What about Bloody Knife? You worried about him?
No! Gall killed Bloody Knife's 2 brothers. Bloody Knife hates the Sioux.
What's that?
Pay call. Custer decided to withhold the soldiers' pay until after we left the fort. He's afraid there'd be too many hangovers and too many desertions if he paid before we left.
Shortly after pay call, Falcon was invited to join Custer for lunch. When Falcon walked up to Custer's double Sibley tent, he saw that a large square canvas had been spread out on the ground in front of the tent. The canvas square was filled with viands of every description. There was a basket of fried chicken, a ham, beans and rice, smoked oysters, tinned peaches, biscuits, butter and jam. There was also a couple of bottles of wine, but Custer, who was a teetotaler, was drinking lemonade. The entire party was sitting on the canvas around the food. Mary Adams, Custer's black maid and cook, was standing nearby.
Falcon, I'm glad you could join us. Pull up a piece of the canvas and have a seat.
I don't mind if I do. We're Boston and Audie Reed.
Boston is earning his keep as a member of the trains. He and Audie Reed are with the wagons. You keep up with politics, Falcon?
I keep up with local politics. One of my brothers is a sheriff back in Colorado. I always make certain that I'm home to vote for him.
You see there, Tom, Colonel McAllister supports his brother. Is it too much for me to expect your support?
If you run for sheriff, Audie, I will surely support you. But when you start talking about running for president, you are a little out of my league.
President?
Maybe. As you know, I have made it very difficult for Grant and his administration over the last few months. There are some who say that because of my congressional appearances, the Republican Party has been greatly weakened. And in a few weeks, the Democrats will be holding a convention in St. Louis to select a candidate for president. On the 27th of June, to be exact. Now, I'm sure you can agree with me when I say that the timing could not be more fortuitous.
I'm not sure I follow you, General.
Don't be dense, man. I have some supporters who will be at the convention in St. Louis, and they will put my name into nomination. When I come away with a big victory over the Sioux, the headlines it generates will ensure that I'm selected. That makes the timing of this expedition extremely critical. I must complete the scout before June 27th.
General, I thought the mission of the expedition was to return the Sioux to the reservations.
It is, Colonel, it is. But tell me, how can an early and successful conclusion to the expedition not be for the good of the mission? I mean, do you see a contradiction there?
No, I see no contradiction.
Well, then, I suggest that we drink a toast to a successful and early conclusion to this noble scout.
Successful and early and safe.
Of course, Sunshine. Successful and early and safe.
May 17th, 1876, Montana Territory. Cleet Harris was driving the wagon, and he pulled back now on the reins.
Whoa, mules, whoa! What did we stop for?
I need to climb up to that butte there and take a look around.
We gonna be here long enough to make some coffee? I sure could use me a cup.
Yeah, I'll go ahead, Brines.
Harris climbed down from his seat, walked to the back of the wagon, untied his horse, and swung into the saddle.
I'm gonna ride up as far as I can, have a look around, then come back. Probably be a half hour or longer. Save some coffee for me.
You got some?
You're gonna make some anyway, aren't you?
Yeah, for me. I ain't got enough coffee to make some for you, too. But if you give me some of yours, I'll make it.
Oh, goddamn.
Harris opened his saddlebag and took out a small cloth sack, then tossed it down to Brian's.
You're one selfish son of a bitch, Brian's. Anyone ever tell you that?
Harris followed the trail that led toward the hill. When the trail started up the side of the rainy butte, he rode for as long as he could. He found a flat area that stuck out to one side. Harris walked out to the edge to have a look. He could see the wagon and the three men who had come with him. From here, the wagon was so small that it looked almost like a child's toy. This vantage point also allowed him to look back along the Heart River. He could see as far as the Little Powder River, but he saw nothing of particular interest to him.
Yeah, good. What with selling Gatling guns to Indians, I sure don't need to see anybody poking around.
Harris worked his way back down the side of the mountain. There, he saw that Bryans, Garin, and Richland had already unsaddled their horses and were making camp.
I think we can make better time without the wagons.
How are we going to carry these guns without a wagon? They weigh about 1,500 pounds each.
They're on caissons, Garin. We just pull them.
Yeah, I guess that'll work.
Better get a good night's sleep. We'll leave first thing in the morning.
Harris, what's the name of this engine we're going to be doing business with?
His name's Cutnose.
Have you ever considered the possibility that Cutnose might just decide to take these guns and then kill us?
I don't think he'd do that.
You mean he might, but you don't think he would?
Well, let's put it this way. We done business before, and I figure he'll want to do business again in the future. Now, why'd he just want to take the guns and kill us? He'd have to find somebody else who's willing to trade with him.
Yeah? All right, if you say so.
May 18th, 1876, Little Heart River. The next morning, as the encampment was getting ready to move out for the day, Falcon walked over to Custer's tent, where the General, Jimmy Calhoun, and Tom Custer were standing out front to tell the three women goodbye. Falcon stood back, close enough to be there, but far enough back to allow him a little privacy.
Oh, I have yellow ribbons for all of you to wear until we get back.
Custer reached down into the side pocket of his buckskin jacket and pulled out three yellow ribbons. One he gave to Jimmy Calhoun, and one he gave to his brother Tom.
We'll pin them on you.
You do know what it means when a woman wears a cavalryman's yellow ribbon, don't you?
No, not exactly.
It means you're his girl.
As Tom pinned the ribbon on Lorena, she glanced over at Falcon with an expression as if to say, I hope you understand. Then she turned back to Tom with a smile.
Excuse me a minute, Tom.
Lorena walked over to Falcon and extended her hand.
Colonel, it has been delightful meeting you. I do hope we meet again.
I'm sure we will.
Lorena glanced back toward Tom.
He is a very good man, you know.
I'm sure he is.
He asked me to be here for him when the regiment returns.
And will you be?
Yes, I think I will be.
Well, I'm sure he'll appreciate it.
Colonel, I...
You don't have to say anything, Miss Wood. Like you said, Tom Custer is a good man.
After Lorena walked back to the paymaster's ambulance, Libby came over to speak to Falcon. She was smiling brightly as she approached.
Colonel McAllister, it was so nice of you to come visit us.
It was nice of you and the General to invite me. I thoroughly enjoyed my visit.
Libby glanced back over his shoulder at Tom Custer, who was now helping Lorena into the ambulance.
Tom seems quite taken with Lorena. He needs someone, if you know what I mean. I hope that isn't a problem for you.
No, of course not. Why should it be a problem?
I don't know. I thought the first night that there seemed to be some mutual interest between you and Miss Wood.
Oh, please, Mrs. Custer, don't worry about it.
I told Audie's orderly to look after the General. I would never say anything like this to the General's face, but... Oh, Colonel McAllister, of all the engagements Audie was in during the war, of all previous Indian engagements, I have never had such an overwhelming sense of foreboding as I do now.
Look at the size of this force, Mrs. Custer. John Bergman won't be the only one looking after the General. Everyone here will be looking out for him, and for each other.
Yes, but you must understand. If there is fighting to be done, Audie always puts himself at the head.
That's because he's a good soldier.
Libby, come! We must go!
I'll be right there.
Excuse me, Colonel.
I'll walk with you, ma'am.
The two of them walked back toward the ambulance, where Berkman stood holding Libby's horse, Dandy. Berkman helped Libby mount, then she nodded to the ambulance driver. The driver returned her nod, then slapped the reins against the backs of the four-horse team. As they headed out, Custer walked up to Falcon.
Libby couldn't hide it from me. She's nervous about this scout.
I think that is probably true of the wife of any soldier who's going off to do battle.
Yes, but that is the way of it, Falcon. A good soldier must divide his time between two mistresses, his wife and the army. And when he's with one, the other must suffer. Are you going out this morning?
Yeah.
Good luck to you.
Dorman was sitting patiently when Falcon returned.
Are you ready?
Colonel, it wasn't me that stood here to watch them pretty women leave.
You got me on that one, Dorman. Did you draw the rations?
I did.
All right, let's go.
May 21st, 1876, Montana Territory. Falcon and Dorman had been riding for most of the day, and they were looking forward to taking a break and letting their horses drink from the small stream just up ahead.
Damn! Colonel McAllister!
Just where the creek curved, a dozen engines came galloping toward them. The weapons they carried, Falcon noticed, were Henry repeating rifles.
This way!
Dorman darted around a rock, and Falcon was right behind him. Once he had the rock between him and the charging engines, Falcon pulled his horse to a stop, jerking back on the reins so hard that the horse almost went down on its haunches.
Here! We'll fight from here! Yeah.
Falcon jerked the army-issue sharps from the saddle sheath, then stepped around the rock with the carbine raised to his shoulder. Dorman raised his rifle as well. In less than a minute, 12 engines who'd believed they had a sure thing saw their number decreased by more than half. Only 5 remained, and they turned and galloped away, leaving their dead behind them.
Damn! You're one hell of an engine fighter, Falcon. I've been at this game for a long time. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that.
Falcon walked over to one of the dead engines and picked up the rifle the engine was carrying.
I'll be damned.
What is it?
The Colorado Home Guard is missing 100 rifles. It looks like we just found a few of them.
You mean in addition to the Gatling guns we're looking for, there's also a bunch of repeating rifles out there?
Yeah.
That ain't good.
No, it ain't good at all. Come on, help me pick up the others.
Falcon put that rifle aside, and for the next minute or so, they wandered through the dead engines, retrieving other rifles.
Damn. This here's Running Bear.
You knew him, did you?
Yeah, I knew the son of a bitch. This here's Cutnose's brother.
I take it you weren't friends.
No, I don't think you could rightly call us friends. Cutnose sure set a big store by him, though, seeing as how he mostly raised him after their pappy was killed. You don't take too kindly to your killing him.
Now tell me, Mr. Dorman, do you really think Cutnose was ready to be friends with me before I killed his brother?
Now that you mention it, I don't reckon you killing his brother is going to make matters any worse.
The Sioux encampment was temporary only, because the 300 engines were on their way to join with others during a time the Sioux called the Moon of Making Fat, at a place called Greasy Grass. Even though it was a temporary settlement, the band of Indians who were following Cut Nose were experienced nomads, and they knew how to set up a camp quickly and efficiently. The nearly 100 teepees were arranged in concentric circles, with each teepee in a precise position within those circles. As far as the occupants of the village were concerned, it didn't matter whether they were going to be in a position for one night or 30 nights. They carried on as if every location was permanent. The position wasn't decided by hierarchy, but by precedence, the exact positioning allowing for friends and relatives to be able to locate each other. The women were busy carving meat into very thin slices and hanging them up to dry. The children were playing games. The old men were sitting in little groups telling stories of old battles and ancient hunts, and the young men were cleaning recently cured game. Now, Cut Nose was aware of the fact that a large group of soldiers had left various military posts to take to the field, and earlier in the day, he sent out a dozen warriors to see where they were and see if they represented any danger to his band. He was shocked when he saw that only 5 of the 12 warriors returned. He was dismayed when he saw that one of those who did not return was his brother, Running Bear.
Where is my brother? Where are the others, Windhawk?
Running Bear is dead. The others are dead.
The Long Knives? Did you see the Long Knives?
No, we did not see the soldiers. We saw only 2. Black White Man and Tall Warrior.
Only 2? But 6 are killed? Did you kill the 2?
No, Cut Nose.
Did you kill 1 of the 2?
No, we did not kill 1 of the 2.
7 were killed, but not 1 of the enemy?
Cut Nose, never have I seen men fight with such fierceness and bravery.
I did not know that Black White Man was a warrior of such skill.
It was not Black White Man. It was Tall Warrior who fought with such skill. It was Tall Warrior who killed Running Bear.
Who is this Tall Warrior? I do not know him.
No one has seen him before. We gave him the name because he is very tall and very ferocious. I believe he was born in Thunder. That is why we do not know him.
I will know him.
Cut Nose pulled his knife and then sliced through one side of his nostril. Cut started bleeding immediately and profusely.
This wound is my brother. I will keep this wound fresh until I have killed the one who killed my brother. Now, I must go to meet Crazy Horse and his people.
Cut Nose dismissed One Hawk, then walked out to greet Crazy Horse. As a young man, Crazy Horse had a vivid dream of a rider in a storm on horseback, who wore his hair long and unbraided, and had a small stone in his ear. The warrior also had a yellow lightning bolt symbol on his cheek, and several small red dots of hail decorating his body. In Crazy Horse's dream, many tried to claim coup on the warrior, but nobody could touch him. People clutched at the rider, but they could not hold him. After the storm, a red-backed hawk flew over the rider's head. When Crazy Horse awakened, he saw, flying over his head, a red-backed hawk, and he knew that was a symbol for him. Like the warrior in his dream, Crazy Horse wore his hair long and unbraided, and he decorated his face and body with the lightning bolt and dots of hail. He also wore a headdress adorned with a red hawk feather.
Where do you take your band?
I go to join with the others at Greasy Grass, Crazy Horse.
Join your band with me. I have many Cheyenne and Oglala.
I am Lakota.
We have Oglala, Brule, Minneconju, Cheyenne. We are gathered from everywhere to defeat the white man in battle, once and for all. It is in this way that we may forever reclaim our land.
I will join you. But when I come, I will bring great medicine with me.
What medicine will you bring, my brother?
I will bring a gun that shoots many times, very fast.
Gatling gun?
Gatling gun, yes. I will have Gatling gun.
With Gatling gun, you will be a chief that many will look up to.
Then, as if noticing it for the first time, Crazy Horse put his finger on Cut Nose's wound.
How?
It is an honor wound for my brother, Running Bear. He was killed by Tall Warrior.
I do not know Tall Warrior.
You will not know him, for I will kill him.
Yes, I can see. It is right that you must kill him.
Crazy Horse remounted, then looked down at Cut Nose.
When you have Gatling gun, you will join me.
Yes.
With the encampment of the 7th Cavalry, Custer raised one of the rifles Falcon and Dorman brought back to camp.
Now, these rifles do fire faster, but the Sharps has greater range. The truth is, if the ammunition manufacturers would do something about the cartridge cases, I do believe the Sharps would be a better weapon.
The Sharps is better for infantry troops, I agree, but for cavalry, I think the Henry would be better.
I think you're right. Unfortunately, the decision is not ours to make.
Custer handed the weapon back to Falcon.
I'm sure you'd prefer to keep this, but if you don't mind, I'd like to pass the others out to my scouts.
Of course I don't mind.
Well, I just ask, because they are your weapons, after all. It is clearly marked on the rifle butt.
Please, General, don't rub it in.
I'm sorry, I meant nothing by it. Anyway, it is the Gatling guns that we're worried about now. No sign of them anywhere?
Not yet, but we will be going out again tomorrow.
Falcon and Dorman had been on the scout for 4 days when they saw several buzzards making circles over one spot.
You see that?
Yeah, I see them.
Sure are a lot of them. Whatever's dead up there is bigger than a rabbit or a deer.
They could smell the stench long before they got there. They saw the wagon first. Then, as they drew closer, they saw the two dead mules. Wolves had been at the mules, and much of the flesh was eaten away, leaving exposed rib cage and entrails. There was an arrow protruding from each of the mules, and three other arrows sticking out of the wagon.
Damn! That is one powerful stink. What is it, you suppose? Prospectors?
I don't know. I don't see any bodies. Wait a minute. Look at that.
On the canvas of the wagon, not obvious as they had approached, but now clearly visible, were stenciled words. Colorado Home Guard.
That's the wagon we've been looking for. The guns aren't here, but I didn't think they would be.
Whoever took them, it wasn't engines. As far as I can tell, the mules weren't killed in any sort of fight. Looks like they've been shot through the head. Don't think engines would have done that.
I think you're right. Harris evidently decided he would be better off without the wagon. These wagons normally take a team of 6. They've taken 4 of the mules with them, 2 for each gun.
It ain't gonna be hard to follow them. Pulling them caissons like they are, why, they might as well be leaving us maps. Depends on how long a head start they have.
From the looks and the smell of the mules, I'd say we're about 6 or 7 days behind them.
Seems about right. Listen, Falcon, you've seen all you need to see here. I gotta get away from this stink, else I'm gonna start puking.
I've seen all I need to see.
Let's get on out of here, then.
May 26, 1876. When Cleed Harris awoke that morning, he saw Cuttonose and at least 30 other Injuns standing there, looking down at him.
Yeah, what the hell? Gary, Bryans, Richland, wake up! Damn! Bryans, I thought you were keeping guard.
I was, but at 4, I turned it over to Richland.
You have Gatling guns?
Gatling guns. Yeah, I got 2 of them.
I want.
Well, that's why we come up here, Chief. We brought them to you. You have any money?
Cuttonose looked at one of the other Injuns who walked back to his horse, then brought 2 cloth bags. He emptied the bags onto the blanket Harris had been sleeping on. The contents were a mixture of gold coins and gold nuggets. Even the quickest estimate convinced Harris that there was more money here than he had anticipated.
Well, it's not as much money as I wanted, but it'll do. We brought the guns, so they're yours.
You show how to use.
Yeah, all right.
Opening the box on the caisson of one of the guns, Harris took out an empty magazine, then showed it to Cuttonose.
This is called a magazine.
Opening one of the cases of ammunition, he took out a handful of bullets and started sticking them down into the magazine.
And before you can shoot the gun, you have to fill the magazine with bullets, like this. Next, you stick it down here, like this. Point at what you want to shoot, and turn this crank. Now, Cuttonose, you try.
Listen to that. That's a Gatling. Whoa, hold it! I don't know what's going on, but we better stop here.
Yeah.
Pulling their carbines from their saddle sheaths, they climbed up the side of the butte to get into position and look down on the other side. Once in position, they saw the two guns and those who were gathered around them. One of the engines was pushing shells into the magazine, while one of the white men was showing him how to do it.
That's Cutnose. He's a mean one, all right. If he could get these guns back to the engines before the general runs into them, why, he could become the top dog among them.
And I recognize two of the white men. That's Cleet Harris, and that one's Jim Guerin. Oh, it's no wonder now that Guerin beat the stagecoach robbery charge. Harris was the foreman of the jury. The two men were in cahoots.
Suddenly, an engine leaped out from behind him and charged with his war club erect. Falcon grabbed the engine by the wrist to keep him from using his war club, then fell on his back, put his feet in the engine's belly, and threw him over.
Harris, up there!
Below him, Cutnose pushed the magazine into place, then elevated the gun.
Damnation!
Falcon and Dorman began returning fire, and one of the white men went down, as well as two of the engines. Cutnose turned and leaped onto one of the mules that were still attached to the Gatling gun. He started the team running. In a matter of moments, all the engines and the whites were gone. The engines going one way and the whites the other.
Which ones we going after?
We have to get that other gun back. We can't let the regiment go up against him. Come on!
Retrieving their horses, Falcon and Dorman rode back down into the flat where they had seen the guns. There were three dead engines and two dead ponies. The engines had gotten away with one of the guns, but the other one was still there. There was one white man lying near the gun, and he was alive, but barely.
They left me. Son of the bitches run off and left me.
Who are you?
Name is Richland. Ken Richland. Oh, you're Falcon McAllister, ain't you?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought so. You don't know me, but I seen you before.
I recognize Cleet Harris and Jim Guerin. Who's the other man?
Oh, why should I tell you that?
Why not? Like you said, they ran off and left you.
Yeah, they did, didn't they?
The third man. What is his name?
His name's Bryans. J. Bryans.
Why did you do this, Richland? Why did you put Gatling guns in the hands of the Indians? Don't you know they're going to use them against whites?
We did it for the money. We got us a lot of money for them guns. Oh, a lot of money.
Well, it's not doing you a lot of good right now, is it?
Standing up, Falcon looked over toward Dorman and saw that he was squatting by one of the engines.
He's still alive?
Not now, he ain't. But he said a few words to me before he passed on. His name was Two Bears.
You know him?
Yeah, I knew him. Falcon, we're in a lot of trouble here.
What do you mean?
According to Two Bears, there's Indians from all over the nations gathering up for this fight. They actually figure on pushing the white man out of here once and for all.
How many Indians we talking about?
They're coming from six tribes. Minneconju, Oglala, Blackfoot, Hunkpapa, Cheyenne, and Sanzark. Maybe as many as 20,000 of them.
20,000?
If all them tribes get together, it'll be that many. Telling you the truth. You're going to have us one hell of a fight on our hands.
You're right. I don't think the general realizes that.
So what do you want to do? Try to run down that gun and go back and tell the general what we found out?
Look.
Falcon pointed to a couple of boxes of ammunition.
They got away with one of the guns, but none of the ammunition.
Don't you think they got bullets?
Not this kind. These are special 50 caliber bullets. The cartridges have to be machine made to fit these guns, or the gun will jam up. We'll spike this gun and burn the ammunition. Without bullets, I don't think they'll be able to do much with the gun they got. We'll go back and warn the general.
May 27th, 1876. The Bighorn Mountains. It was getting dark as Falcon and Dorman followed the path of a swift-running mountain stream.
Someone down there.
Where?
Down there in that ravine, you see him?
I see something. I don't know if it's a rider or just an animal. It's too dark to make out.
We best keep our eyes open. If that's an engine and we seen him, that means he sure as hell seen us.
They moved into some trees, tied off their horses, then stretched out on the ground.
Ben Ting tells me you were married to a Sioux.
Yeah, I was.
I was married to a Cheyenne.
I'll be damned. Should have known there was something I liked about you. That engine I was talking to back there, Two Bears, he was my brother-in-law.
Oh, too bad.
Yeah, well, I didn't much care for the sumbitch when I was married to his sister.
Where are you from, Dorman?
You'd asked me that 15 years ago, I wouldn't have given you an answer. I'd have figured you was trying to take me back.
Take you back?
I was born a slave.
I wouldn't have taken you back.
Someone told me that you was in the rebel army.
I was. My brother was in the Yankee army. But the thing is, neither of us held with slavery.
And how come you fought for the South?
There's a lot more to that war than slavery.
Not for me, there wasn't.
Yeah, I can understand that.
My pap was a Jamaica man. My mama was a slave woman down in Louisiana for the Dorman family. When I got old enough, around 15 or so, I reckon, I just up and runned off. Kept on a running and a dodging, avoiding anyone I thought might be a slave catcher. But finally I wound up out here. Some Sioux found me wandering around in the Pahasapa, more dead than alive. They took me back to the village with them, fed me, brought me back to life, so to speak. You can understand why I made friends with them. They didn't quite know what to make of me. I was the first black man any of them ever seen. They called me Black White Man. Black White Man. But I don't reckon being called a white man would have got me into any restaurants back where I come from. Anyhow, I married up with a Sioux woman, stayed with her till she up and died on me. Then, didn't really feel like staying with the Injuns any longer, so I left. Started carrying mail, chopping and selling wood, till a general hired me to do some scouting for him. Lots of folks don't know this, Falcon, but them soldier boys only get $13 a month. You know how much money I get?
I don't have any idea.
I'm getting $100 a month. You imagine that? A colored fella like me getting $100 a month.
That's a lot of money, all right.
Yes, sir, it is. Of course, question is it enough money to get myself killed over?
Do you think that's likely?
I don't know. If I didn't tell you I was a sight more fearful about this particular scout than any other I'd been on, I'd be lying to you.
What makes you fearful?
Even before we left Fort Lincoln to come on this scout, I seen me a couple Injuns that I know. They say there's a feeling running amongst the Injuns that something big is going to happen, like Two Bears told me. They're actually planning to run all the white men out of Montana and Dakota Territory. I don't mind telling you that I don't feel none too particular good about this.
That's funny. Libby Custer has the same feeling.
When women has feelings like that, you ought to pay attention to them. Lots of times, women just knows more than men.
I wouldn't want to argue with that. But are we going to talk all night or get some sleep?
I don't know about you. I'm going to get me some sleep. If you answer me this time, you'll be talking to yourself.
Both men slept well, and both were awake by sunrise the next morning. After a cold breakfast of jerky and water, they saddled up and got underway, riding as alertly as possible. As they approached each knoll, one of them would dismount and hand the reins of his horse to the other, then go up to the top of the knoll to have a look around before riding over it. They had been taking turns doing that all morning, and this time it was Dorman's turn. Giving his horse over to Falcon, the scout moved cautiously to the top. There, he got down on his stomach, took off his hat, and rose up to have a quick look over the crest. Suddenly, Dorman spun around, and bending low, ran back to his horse.
We gotta get out of here now! Now!
The two horses raced toward a bluff that was some distance ahead of them. Not until they reached the bluff did they dismount and pull their horses in behind some trees.
Tie them off and come up here and have a look.
Falcon did as Dorman suggested, and no sooner did he reach the top than he saw what had Dorman spooked. There were scores upon scores of Injuns, at least 100, maybe more. They were now where Falcon and Dorman had been but a few moments earlier, and as the Injuns advanced down the side of the knoll, they were scattered out across the valley, as if they were looking for something.
They've spotted our trail.
They have that, all right. They're gonna be on us like a fly on shit if we don't get out of here.
I'm with you. Let's go.
The two men started out at a trot, taking advantage of the flat ground while they could. By the time they reached the base of the mountain, the Injuns had discovered them. And though they were still some distance away, they were coming up hard and fast.
If we don't give these horses a blow, we're gonna kill them.
I think you're right. All right, we'll let them take a break.
The two men dismounted. Both men unsaddled their mounts and, for the next few minutes, allowed the horses to crop the nearby grass. At the end of half an hour, they put the saddles back on and had just finished when Falcon saw the engines closing fast.
There they are. We gotta get out of here. Quick, into that timber. It's our only chance.
Falcon's horse was hit by a bullet. It stumbled and nearly went down, but it recovered and continued to run, keeping pace with Dorman's mount despite its wound. Just as they reached the timber, Dorman's horse was also hit, and it was limping badly as it carried Dorman into the woods. Once inside the tree line, Falcon and Dorman hastily dismounted at the edge.
Damn! The bullet that hit my horse also shattered the chamber of my Henry.
Tossing the useless Henry aside, Falcon drew his pistol. Falcon and Dorman's fire was so accurate that within a few moments, at least 10 of the engines lay dead or dying on the field. The rest of the engines withdrew from immediate pistol range, but they didn't leave the field of battle. Instead, they just gathered on the other side of the open area, out of range not only of Falcon's pistols, but of Dorman's rifle.
Look here, Falcon. Ain't that Cutnose there leading them?
Yeah, that's him, all right.
Next time them heathen bastards come across, let's make particular sure we kill that sumbitch. Him being the leader, if we kill him, it might take some of the fight out of the rest of them.
We'll have to get him into range. If he stays back there and directs the fight, we'll never get a chance at him.
Oh, I'll get that sumbitch into range, all right.
How are you going to do that?
I'm going to use you as bait.
I'm not sure that I'm all that excited about being used as bait, but I have to admit that I'm interested in seeing how you're going to do that.
Cutnose! The white man who killed your brother's here! He's waiting for you!
Black white man, we fed you when you were hungry. We gave you blankets when you were cold. You married one of our women, and your children live with us now. You were our blood brother. Why do you fight with Tall Warrior against us? You have betrayed us. When we catch you, we will show you our anger.
Well, it appears you have a name. You are Tall Warrior.
I guess I could have a worse name.
They think I betrayed them.
This is just a guess, but I'd say they're pretty mad at you.
You're right. But so far, old Cutnose ain't mad enough to come out on his own. I guess I'm gonna have to try again.
Cutnose! I speak for Tall Warrior. Tall Warrior says that Running Bear died a coward. Tall Warrior believes you are a coward.
Tall Warrior is the coward! He will not meet me in the test. I will kill Tall Warrior. Then we will kill you, white black man. We will let the woman roast you as if you were a buffalo hump.
Do you think he really would meet me in a fair fight?
Any other time he might, but I think if you showed yourself now, they'd kill you.
Tall Warrior says he will not fight a coward. Tall Warrior says to send your women after us. Your women are braver than you are!
Tell Tall Warrior it is a good day for him to die! It is a good day for you to die!
Well, I think we did it. Old Cutnose is so mad now, he can barely breathe. I reckon they'll be coming after us. When he does, all we gotta do is shoot the sumbitch.
Good job, Dorman. But wait until he gets into pistol range. With both of us shooting, the chances of getting him are a lot better.
Right.
Falcon waited, listening to the rolling thunder of the horse hooves and watching the cloud of dust billowing up behind him as the engines galloped across the plain, rapidly closing the distance between them.
You gonna let me know when you think he's in your range, right, Falcon?
Yeah, just hold on a minute.
Now!
Both Falcon and Dorman fired and Cutnose went down. The others, seeing that, brought their horses to an abrupt halt, then turned and galloped back to the shelter of the rocks and trees.
By damn, I don't reckon Cutnose gonna be leading them on any more charges.
The rest of the engines were at least 50 yards beyond Cutnose's body and were still riding hard to get out of range.
How much ammunition you got left?
I don't know, maybe 20 or so shells. What about you?
Just what's in my pistol. You may as well take the ammunition that's in my saddlebag. It's for the Henry, and the one I've got is worthless.
We aren't gonna be able to hold off in many more charges like that one we just faced, and they're gonna be coming after us.
Yeah, well, we aren't going too far on these horses. Both of them are pretty badly wounded.
You're right. But we still have to get out of here. You got any suggestions?
Have you ever been on the other side of this mountain?
Yeah.
What's on the other side?
Another mountain.
And then?
Another mountain.
All right, after we get over all the mountains, what's there?
A little Missouri River.
Isn't that where Custer is supposed to be?
Yeah, he is. Hell, if we could get over these mountains, we could join back up with him.
Then what are we waiting for?
How are we gonna go? There's no pass here. There's no way the horses could make it over these mountains, even if they was both healthy, which they ain't.
Hell, my horse is barely standing as it is.
Yeah, I know. But if our horses couldn't make it, even if they were healthy, then that means the engine's horses can't make it either. And if we get a head start on them, we'll have the advantage over them. We'll go by Shank's mare.
That's gonna be one hell of a walk, Falcon. I'm game if you are. But what do you mean head start? They ain't more than 300 or 400 yards behind us. That sure as hell ain't much of a head start.
We'll fire a few shots before we leave. The Indians don't know our horses are wounded. If we leave the horses here, that might convince the Indians that we're still here, just waiting under cover till we get a good shot, the way we did with Cut Nose.
Yeah. Yeah, it just might work at that.
Fire a couple of shots at him and let's go.
The pair moved through the back of the little copse of trees where they had taken their stand, rushed through the bushes, ran over pebbles, and past rocks and boulders until they started climbing.
Those gonna be some mad engines.
Damn, Dorman. You mean they weren't already mad?
The two men climbed for the rest of the day, reaching the highest peak in the entire range. Once there, they looked back. From this vantage point, they could see for miles.
Sweet fancy Moses, look at that!
Falcon saw exactly what Dorman was pointing at. Hundreds, maybe thousands of engines. These weren't the engines who were chasing them. These were other engines. Not only warriors, but engine ponies pulling lodge poles, accompanied by women and children, moving along several different trails, separated from each other, but all going in the same general direction.
Have you ever seen that many Indians at one time?
No, sir, I have not. Two Bears was right. These engines is coming from everywhere.
We have to tell Custer about this. I don't think he has any idea what he's letting himself in for.
You don't really know General all that well, do you?
I haven't known him very long. Why do you ask?
Because it ain't gonna make no never mind what we tell him. He has his mind made up to go after the engines, and that's exactly what he's gonna do, no matter how many of them there is.
Well, we'll just have to convince him.
For the next 3 days, Falcon and Dorman climbed mountains, reaching the top of one, only to see another to be negotiated, and another after that. They had taken their canteens and what rations they could carry with them, but by the third day they had neither food nor water left, and they were exhausted. To make matters worse, they saw no game at these elevations.
We're going to have to stop here for a while. I don't think I can go any farther.
Dorman sat down and pulled off his shoes and socks. His feet were covered with blisters.
Oh, look at that. You go on if you can. I reckon I'm just gonna lay here till I die.
Isaiah, we've come this far. We can't give up now. We don't have any food. We don't have any water. We've got to go on.
Oh, it's coming on nightfall. Reckon if we just spend the night here, maybe get a little rest, I'll be ready to go on come morning.
All right. The truth is, I could use a little rest myself. We'll spend the night here.
They bivouacked under some overhanging rocks on the top of one of the highest peaks in the Bighorn Range. During the night, the temperature fell very near to the freezing point. The conditions for Falcon and Dorman were miserable, because neither of them had anything more than the clothes on their back. Cold, heavy rain fell, whipped by a roaring wind that uprooted trees by the hundreds. Two men spent a miserable, sleepless night. On the morning of June 1st, they found a trail that made walking a little easier than what they had been used to, so they were able to make better time on that day. Dorman estimated that they only had about 20 miles to go now, and because the trail was not as steep, it wouldn't be as hard as the first part of their journey. But as they were much weaker than they had been when they started the ordeal, they weren't able to take as much advantage of the easier trail as they had thought. When they reached the bottom of this hill, though, they found a stream, and they drank thirstily.
Good God, look there.
Falcon pointed to two soldiers on horseback.
Hold on there!
The two soldiers swung toward Falcon and Dorman with their pistols in their hands.
He's up there. We're scouting for the 7th. We're trying to get back to the regiment. We ran into some Indians and lost our horses.
And we'd appreciate it if you'd ride back and return with a couple mounts for us.
We're bivouacked only about 5 miles back. You can walk it in under an hour.
Sonny, we done walked and climbed and walked for nigh on to 50 miles now. And we ain't in no mood to walk another 50 yards. Just go back in and get us them horses, like the man said.
All right. You two wait right here.
How long's gonna take you?
I figure we'll be back in about an hour. Maybe a little less.
As the two young troopers rode off, Falcon and Dorman found a place under a tree where they could sit and wait.
You know what I'm gonna do when this here scout's over?
What's that?
I'm gonna go back to Louisiana and look up my mama. That is, if she's still alive. I reckon the fact I run away as a slave won't be held against me now.
No, I don't think it will.
Got me some money, too. Don't hardly nobody know this, because I ain't never told no one about it before. But the truth is, I got me near about $5,000 of money I done saved up over the years. I figure if I can go back to Louisiana, find my mama, I can more than likely get me and her a place to live and just spend the rest of my days down there.
That sounds like a good idea.
Tell you what, Falcon, I get me a place down there. You'll have to come to Louisiana and pay me a visit sometime.
Well, I may just do that.
One thing about Louisiana, ain't no Indians down there wanting to lift my scalp. And another good thing is, it don't never snow. And if I don't never see me no more snow, I wouldn't miss it none at all.
If you do find your mother, I'm sure she'll be very proud of you. Start out like you did, you've made a hell of a good life for yourself.
I have at that, haven't I? I wonder how much longer before them soldier boys get back.
They said they'd be back inside an hour. It hasn't been an hour yet.
About 5 minutes later, the pair saw a group of soldiers come galloping toward them.
There they are. Never thought I'd feel this good about seeing a bunch of soldier boys, but I'm right proud to see them troopers.
True to his word, the soldier had returned in less than an hour. Lieutenant Weir was with him, along with 10 other troopers. There were also 2 extra horses, as well as some roasted elk and biscuits.
The General's girl Mary made these biscuits this morning. She said she thought you might like them. I think she's got her cap set for you, Dorman. When she heard you were out here, she made certain I brought some of her biscuits.
Lieutenant, you tell Mary if we even find us so much as a preacher, I'll marry her before we even get back to the fort.
I wouldn't make any promises to her of that nature, Dorman. I think she'd take you up on it. Then you'd have the General upset with you for taking his cook away from him.